This episode is brought to you in part by Rotman Executive Programs. Now, I'm sure you've heard of this newfangled thing called generative AI. Well, the Rotman School of Management is here to help you dive in to the risks and rewards of this new technology. Elevate your skills to advance your career and future-proof your organization with Rotman's Generative AI and Organizational Transformation Program. Visit uoft.me/rotmanai to learn more. Once again, that's www.uoft.me/rotmanai. This episode is also brought to you in part by Douglas. Did you know that Douglas offers a 365-night trial for their mattresses? Now, I'm not an impulse shopper, so getting to try out a product for an entire year sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand. So, Jordan, how many burritos do you think you've made in your life?
A lot of burritos, Archie. More burritos than anyone else you know.
Okay, well, we did the math on this earlier, so come on, just tell me, what's the number of burritos that we discovered that you've made?
I've made over 50,000 burritos, which is, I dare someone to say that they've made more burritos than me, unless they had the same job that I did.
And what was that job?
I worked at a Mucho Burrito for about 7 years. Anyone who's worked one of these kinds of jobs knows what it's like. You know, this was just a behind-the-counter service job, minimum wage. You know, I had a lot of regulars that I really, really liked, but I think I learned more doing this job about how to handle difficult situations and rude people than I have at any other experience in my life. Archie, I know you've also worked a lot of jobs. Tell me a little bit about your working history.
Oh, yeah. I've worked a lot of pretty strange jobs before I got into journalism. My favorite was easily being a tower guard at Splashdown Water Park, which I can tell you is still the most fun I've basically ever had at work. But I was everything from a taxi dispatcher to a bottler in a nail polish remover factory. So taking like big bottles of nail polish remover and putting them into smaller ones and slowly losing all of my brain cells. I, you know, refereed hockey. I did a ton of data entry, all kinds of things. But I will say, I think the job that I disliked the most was probably Tim Hortons, another customer service job. And I think the reason for that is because people are really, really mean to you when they haven't had their morning coffee yet.
Archie, I worked in coffee too, and I respectfully, I think you hating this job is just a you thing. I don't think you have what it takes to really be a barista. I would literally do anything to be a barista again.
You'd rather be a barista than be a journalist?
Absolutely. People hate journalists. We're kind of pretentious for people who could literally be laid off at any instant. But you know who they love? Their cute little barista across the counter making them their little bean juice.
Okay, but Noor, you're from Qatar. My understanding is that maybe people who live in Qatar have a kind of a different relationship to work than what we have here. You think that's fair?
Yeah, if I lived in Qatar, I am certain I would have never worked a barista job the way that I did in Canada. And I go back quite regularly. And the people that are working behind the coffee counters, at the restaurants, at the retail stores, or on construction sites, these types of jobs are entirely made up of migrant workers from the quote-unquote global south. And these are people who are constantly dehumanized and reduced to the mere label of a worker. And look, I know that many people listening are going to cringe at this notion because, trust me, I get the inherent injustice and lack of dignity in this kind of treatment. Trust me, I've lived there my whole life. But what surprised me during my time here in Canada is the harsh realization that similar dynamics exist here. And I know people are going to get upset because, yes, the context and the severity may differ. But honestly, I feel like Canada is headed in that direction.
The majority of us, the people listening to this podcast, we're all workers of one kind or another. And it's natural for work to become basically your whole identity. After all, when you ask children what they want to be when they grow up, they don't say, I want to be a good person. They say something like, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a pilot, or some other kind of job. And most of us spend at least 8 hours a day, 5 days a week at work. But add up the amount of time you spend going to and from work, thinking about work, and complaining about your job, and it becomes clear that this is the main thing that we do in our lives. But the nature of work has changed so dramatically, even over the last 10 years. For those of us who work in journalism, the change has been almost overwhelming.
Media companies, including Bell, which owns CTV, have been hit by layoffs this year. And today, two more revealed they are also cutting.
LA Times announcing massive layoffs today, cutting the jobs of at least 115 employees. It's the largest workforce reduction in the paper's 142-year history.
You know, when I began working in this industry more than a decade ago, things were already pretty bad. I remember this statistic from years ago that honestly scared the shit out of me at the time. From 2008 to 2013, the CMG, which is one of the big media unions, estimated that there had been over 10,000 layoffs. The first time I got a job at a major publication, it was the Toronto Star, and I had my pay cut twice before I'd even started the gig. At my next job at Canadian Business Magazine, I briefly ended up homeless because I didn't get paid until 6 weeks after I started. And things have only gotten worse. CBC is cutting 800 positions this year while their executives got around $15 million in bonuses last year. Bell Media is laying off an astonishing 4,800 people. Bell Media's president, Wade Oosterman, he made just over $5 million in total compensation last year. But of course, it's not just journalists who have it rough. Not by a long shot. Candleland's offices are in downtown Toronto. And every evening when I leave here from work and walk down Queen Street, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of delivery people lined up outside of all of the restaurants, waiting in the cold, ready to hop on their bikes to wherever the app tells them to go. Now, in Ontario, they're not even considered employees of the companies that they do these deliveries for. And on average, they make less than minimum wage. And here's the thing. It didn't used to be this way. It's not like food delivery is some kind of newfangled job that didn't exist before the age of smartphones. People have been delivering pizza since before my parents were born, and they were considered employees. And I bet so many of you listening have seen the changes in your jobs and in your industries. And aside from the white-collar workers who can more easily work from home, I'm willing to bet that those changes have mostly been for the worse. This season, we're going to be talking about work and what it means to be a laborer in Canada today. And the question I want to ask more than anything else is, how exactly did things get so damn bad? I'm Arshi Mann, and this is Commons. More after the break. This episode is brought to you in part by AG1. Now, it feels like every time I look at my phone and open a damn app, I'm bombarded with advice about how to live a healthier life. Now, it can be a lot to take in, and the thing is, I do want to take good care of myself, I guess. It's just that there's got to be a simpler way than parsing the endless stream of so-called health gurus to develop a routine that could work for me. And that's the best thing about AG1 by Athletic Greens. They make it so easy to get your daily vitamins and minerals. One scoop of AG1 is all you need for your day, and it's packed with 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients. If you want to take ownership over your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 now, and you'll get a free welcome kit that includes a shaker bottle, canister, and metal scoop, along with 5 free travel packs and a 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2, all with your first purchase. Just go to drinkag1.com/commons. That's drinkag1.com/commons. So to begin answering the question of why things seem to have gotten worse for workers in Canada, there was one person in particular that I wanted to talk to.
I am Jim Stanford, and I'm the economist and director of the Center for Future Work, which is a labor economics think tank with offices in Vancouver and Australia.
Now, I spend a lot of time reading through the business sections of Canadian newspapers, and it often feels like most writers and columnists are all singing from the exact same hymnal. That balanced budgets, low taxes, and minimal regulations will lead to economic prosperity for all Canadians, and that we need to focus on the supposed needs of Canadian enterprise. But not Jim. He first came to prominence working as a union economist for the Canadian auto workers, and his writing always has had a worker-centric ethos at the heart of it. But the main reason that Jim was the first person I wanted to feature on our series is because I think the way in which most of us talk about economics is fundamentally flawed. So many politicians, journalists, and economists talk about economics as if it's a kind of science, like geology or meteorology. Economic outcomes are just like earthquakes or hurricanes, subject to laws of nature beyond our very control. But the obvious truth is that the economy is fundamentally shaped by very human choices, and by people often acting in their own self-interest.
Economic discourse is dominated by people from powerful places that have a vested interest in the status quo. Most of the economists that you'll see on TV commenting on the latest GDP numbers or whatever work for the major chartered banks or the business associations or, frankly, from universities that get a lot of corporate funding and have their agenda sort of tailored as a result of that. Economics is a contested subject. It is not like physics or some other science, even though many economists pretend that it is. They like to use a lot of numbers and graphs and formulas to make it seem like it's science, as opposed to more of a social science, where you inevitably have value judgments and vested interests and conflict embedded in it.
According to Jim, to understand how we got to where we are, we have to go back to the years immediately following World War II.
In the wake of World War II is when we built that whole kind of post-war social contract, if you like, that was combined with strong business investment. The private sector was strong and expansive, but also a growing government sector, rising taxes, expanding social programs, and growing unions, growing both in numbers and in militants. So by the 1970s, you had a situation where the standard of living of the average Canadian worker had doubled in the three decades since World War II. And we've never seen a period in the history of capitalism where workers did that well.
So what happened?
Unfortunately, the folks at the other end of that, the kind of the financial sector and the corporate wealth and rich people basically didn't like the way the ship was headed in Canada and elsewhere. And this is when in the late 70s, we saw the emergence of an organized attempt to turn it around.
Now, some of you might be familiar with this part of the story. In the 1970s, Western economies were confronted by a number of new challenges that baffled policymakers. Unemployment and inflation were rising at the same time, something that's just not supposed to happen. Now, there were a number of complicated geopolitical reasons that this stagflation was taking place, including the end of global currency controls and the oil embargo in the aftermath of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. This economic malaise opened up space for a new breed of economists and political thinkers to challenge the post-war economic orthodoxy. No longer did we believe it was essential for workers to be paid well enough to purchase the products that they were creating, or that strong government regulations were necessary to protect the public, or that large corporate monopolies were bad for the economy. Instead, this new vein of thinking put workers, and especially unions, right in the crosshairs.
It's gone by different names. Originally, you would have called it neoconservatism, perhaps, associated politically with Thatcher and Reagan, but economically with people like Paul Volcker, the head of the U.S. Federal Reserve in the late 70s, who's the one who ushered in this tight money, austere approach to managing the macroeconomy. And we eventually followed those directions in Canada. So since then, workers in a way have been on the defensive, trying to hang on to stuff that we won in the past.
In the U.S., Ronald Reagan fired all air traffic controllers in his first year in office after they took part in a strike. In the U.K., Margaret Thatcher put down striking coal miners in a brutal fashion. And in Canada, that anti-worker, anti-union sentiment was also beginning to thrive. It was Pierre Trudeau who first introduced wage caps in an ill-fated attempt to fight the inflation of the 1970s. And then in the 1980s, Brian Mulroney, a bona fide friend of big business, was elected as prime minister. Mulroney decimated the unemployment insurance system, cutting all federal funding to the program, and instead forcing the money to come entirely from workers and employers. And while Mulroney wasn't quite the ideologue that either Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher were, he turned the issue of free trade into his defining policy. Now, I really don't want to oversimplify things here. Canadian politics of the 1980s often had more to do with regional differences than ideological issues. For instance, Quebec, which traditionally has more of a social democratic outlook, was also much more enthusiastic about free trade than Ontario was. But I think what matters here is how the idea of free trade was pitched to Canadians. Politicians and business leaders primarily appeal to Canadians as consumers and not as workers. They acknowledge that a lot of jobs would probably go away, especially in manufacturing. But they argued that, in a way, this was a good thing. Canadian businesses needed to be more dynamic, more mobile, more flexible. And even more importantly, it would be cheaper for the average Canadian to buy all kinds of goods. So even if we lost out as workers, we'd win as consumers. And to me, this is an important ideological turning point. The moment when we stopped thinking of ourselves as people who worked for a living and started thinking about ourselves as people who bought things. Now, there's still substantial debate about whether or not free trade was a good outcome for the average Canadian, but whatever you think, it's impossible to argue that free trade was implemented for the benefit of workers. After all, almost every major union opposed it. And in the 1990s, Canadian workers had to endure another damaging blow. In an effort to reduce the deficit, the Jean Chrétien Liberals undertook one of the most significant austerity campaigns in the Western world. They slashed social services, privatized government functions, and further restricted the rights of workers. And unemployment insurance was once again a major target. Even though the federal government was no longer paying for it, the Chrétien government made it even harder for Canadian workers to qualify. When Mulroney first came into office, around 80% of unemployed Canadians received assistance. By the time Chrétien left, that number was less than half. And here's why I think it's important to recount this history. It shows just how much we still think that it was a good thing that governments stepped on the interests of working people. Because today, the consensus amongst our political, business, and journalistic elites is that free trade and Chrétien's austerity are the greatest examples of proper economic stewardship in Canada's recent history. And these weren't the only measures that impacted workers in a negative way. There was so much more. Here's Jim Stanford again.
Starting in the 80s and then the 90s, we saw a whole shift in many parts of Canada, many provinces and federally, in the nature of labor law, for example, to make it harder for unions to get organized and certified, to make it harder for unions to use their power to increase wages and improve working conditions. Much, much more frequent use of government dictates like back-to-work orders or enforced wage caps on workers.
Between 1982 and 2019, Canada's federal and provincial governments passed 230 individual pieces of legislation restricting the rights of workers. These include back-to-work bills for striking workers, laws that suspend the rights of certain classes of workers to collectively bargain, and a whole host of restrictions on what unions can do. And this long-term legislative assault has had an enormous impact. The percentage of private sector workers in Canada who have a union job has dropped from 30% to around 15%. Now, if you compare that to a country like Norway, they have around 38% of their private sector workers who are unionized. Union membership isn't the only way to measure how well workers are being treated, but these plummeting numbers reflect the raw deal that Canadian workers have gotten over the last few decades. In the decades following World War II, Canadian workers made extraordinary progress. But in the 1980s and 90s, many of those hard-fought gains were lost. Today, the arguments against workers are a little bit different. Maybe the most ubiquitous is the ever-present grousing about the so-called skills shortage, or labor shortage. Here's Jim Stanford again.
Well, we have seen a situation, say, starting in the mid-2010s, when the unemployment rate in Canada did decline to a lower level than had been typical. In the early days of what you could call the kind of neoliberal or neoconservative era, unemployment in Canada became quite high. After the recessions of the early 80s and the early 90s, it wasn't uncommon at all to have 8 or 9 or 10% unemployment in Canada. And that caused all kinds of social and economic problems, including suppressing wage growth. And it was, in a way, a deliberate outcome. Part of the cold bath strategy, if you like, of that economic policy was to discipline workers, break the idea that workers were entitled to something, break the idea that your kids should be better off than you, kind of claw back people's expectations about what they can expect from life, and as a result, produce a more compliant and lower cost labor force. Now, eventually, over time, in a way, that worked, in part through the deunionization that we were just speaking about, and the desperation that is created by a high and ongoing unemployment rate. So the system was able to tolerate a somewhat lower unemployment rate.
And of course, a lower unemployment rate is exactly what most politicians claim they're fighting for. But when there's fewer people who are unemployed, that means workers have more leverage. And businesses do not like that situation.
Employers started to look at that relatively lower unemployment rate and realize, hey, this world that I have been accustomed to, where I can put a job ad out and get 20 fully qualified resumes the next morning, okay? The world I've become accustomed to where, you know, Canadians were desperate for a job and willing to take it, and in fact, probably willing to take it for less money. That world might be disappearing, and I don't like it. So that was when you began to hear these complaints from the business community about the so-called labor shortage.
Now, if you're a sicko like me and you love reading the Globe and Mail's business section every day, then you're probably very familiar with the idea of a labor shortage. And even if you're not a sicko like me, I bet you've encountered the phenomenon of an employer demanding that you have a degree, 5 years of experience on the job, and immaculate references for what amounts to an entry-level gig. And of course, it would be absolute nonsense to even wonder why that employer couldn't train someone to fill such a position.
You know, in the olden days, companies would take people on as apprentices and work them through for years and years of training while they developed their skills and had the breadth to do the full job. Nowadays, they just want to snap their finger and have someone who's got all that and have them come in from outside. They want either the government to pay for all that training or they want to poach trained workers from other companies. At any rate, this ongoing complaint about labor shortage, I think, was vastly, vastly overstated and came from the self-interest of employers who want a ready supply of available labor at any point in time, and they want someone else to pay for the cost of training that labor. Yes, there are some specific high-skill occupations in healthcare, for example, or information and communication technology where it's hard to find people with the right mix of skills, and we have to pay attention to that. But in general, we have not run out of workers in Canada, far from it. We actually benefit in a society where labor is scarce rather than abundant and desperate. Businesses like a world where labor is abundant and desperate because it's cheaper and easier for them. But the rest of us should be absolutely skeptical of these claims about so-called labor shortage.
And even today, policymakers and employers pray at the altar of quote-unquote labor flexibility. And the so-called gig economy has been the answer to their prayers.
Employers learned that if they could shift the risks of ups and downs in their business onto their workers instead of onto them, they could be more nimble and more insulated against, the possibility of an economic downturn, for example. And this is where we saw a big shift towards temporary work, contract work, various types of outsourced jobs, greater use of part-time work, especially irregular part-time work, and culminating really in the gig or platform model of employment, where labor is perfectly flexible in the sense that the business, like Uber, has no obligation whatsoever to the worker except for the specific moments that they have a passenger in their car. Otherwise, they're off the books and they're free.
Gig work is the ultimate ideological expression of the cult of labor flexibility.
All you do is you say that's not a worker, that's a contractor, and they're running their own little business from their car, and I give them the right to sign on to the app and take a passenger. But other than that, I wash my hands of it, including on things like pensions and workers' compensation, where other employers have an obligation.
And to me, one of the clearest distillations of how workers have become punching bags came in 2022. The world was recovering from the worst of the COVID pandemic. And Canada, like many other countries, was racked by inflation, caused primarily by supply shocks throughout the globe. And the Bank of Canada, whose job it is to protect us from inflation, went out of its way to put the blame on Canadian workers.
I think that the people at the Bank of Canada and other conventional economists didn't pay enough attention to the kind of one-off unique nature of the challenge that we face coming out of the pandemic. They went back to their 1990s textbooks, which said inflation is caused by too much spending power, generally because the unemployment rate is too low. And therefore, we have to increase interest rates to reduce that spending power and recreate a adequate level of unemployment in the economy.
Now, a lot of the coverage of monetary policy and interest rates tends to get quite technical, but it's a lot more simple than it seems. Prices for all kinds of goods were rising, but that was largely because of the pandemic, which had led to all kinds of supply shortages around the world. But the Bank of Canada acted as if it was all being caused by workers spending too much money. So we all needed to be taken down a notch.
The governor of the Bank of Canada, Tiff Macklem, said this explicitly. He gave a remarkable speech in late 2022, where he just came out and said, unemployment's too low, we got to get it up. And at that point, unemployment was around 5%. Today, it's closer to 6%. So yay, it's working after 2 years of very, very rapid interest rate increases and lots of pain among Canadian households. Yay, yay, unemployment's up.
But Macklem went even further than that. In a speech to the Canadian Federation of Small Businesses in July 2022, he told employers that they shouldn't raise wages to keep up with inflation. He said this despite the fact that there was no evidence that reckless wage increases were in any way responsible for inflation.
If it was a wage-led problem, then you should have seen wages rising first and prices following, and you should have seen profits falling or being squeezed as companies tried to preserve their profits despite rising labor costs. In fact, it was the exact opposite this time.
Now, despite the fact that he's a governor of the Bank of Canada, Tiff Macklem's comments largely flew under the radar. But I have to tell you that I haven't been able to stop thinking about what he said, because his speech was in 2022. The worst of the COVID pandemic had just subsided. Over the last 2 years, dozens and dozens and dozens of workers died trying to keep the economy afloat. Thousands upon thousands more risked their lives every day, including many members of my own family. And frankly, it infuriates me that this man who has so much power over our economic destinies told business owners that it could be damaging to the Canadian economy to give workers too much of a raise. Macklem feared that higher wages would lead to a so-called wage price spiral where inflation would get out of control. But frankly, he had the economics all wrong. There is almost no evidence that points to inflation over the last few years being caused by wages or employment being too high. To me, Tiff Macklem's comments were the clearest distillation of the prevailing ideology that governs our lives. That workers are the problem. That we're too lazy. That we're too entitled. That we simply have it too good.
One dimension of this whole argument about the so-called labor shortage is this idea that, somehow modern workers don't have the same work ethic as was true in the past. And again, you hear this from employers. They often blame the employment insurance system or other types of protections, or else they just, say kind of things about the new generation that they just don't have the same work ethic as we did when we were youngsters. And the economic evidence is overwhelming that that's not true.
I think a lot of us are used to the idea that there's a war on work, that people nowadays just aren't willing to put in the necessary effort to get the job done. But I've started to wonder about something different. Is there a war on workers? And so I asked Jim directly, am I just being paranoid or am I onto something? And his answer, there absolutely is.
I'm not saying that it was a conspiracy and they met in a small room and said, we're going to do this. On the other hand, I will tell you, Archie, I've learned over the years that just because I'm paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not following me, okay?
So on this season of Commons, this is what we'll be digging into. What is it like to be a worker in this country at a time when workers continue to be under attack? From nurses.
We're underpaid, we're understaffed, ill-equipped, and no respect. I'm at the end of the line.
To farmers.
Canada's the one that has developed these programs, and we've got to hold them responsible.
To fishers.
It seems like every decision now is to get rid of us.
How is exempting people from minimum wage legislation, union rights, basic occupational health and safety rights, how does that advance their rehabilitation?
We'll be bringing you stories from across the country, telling you about the people who keep Canada on its feet. That's your episode of Commons. This is our first episode in our new season on work. We have so much more in store for you. If you like this episode, please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet us at CommonsPod. You can also email me, Archie@CanadaLand.com. This episode was produced by me, Jordan Cornish, and Noor Azria. Our production coordinator is Andre Proulx. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Puglesi, and our music is by Nathan Burley. You can listen to Commons ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. If you value this podcast, please support us. We rely on listeners like you paying for journalism, and as a supporter, you will get premium access to all of our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content. You'll also get our exclusive newsletter, discounts on Canada Land merch, invites and tickets to our live and virtual events, and more than anything, you'll be a part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis. And you'll be keeping our work free and accessible to everybody else. Come join us. Click the link in your show notes or go to CanadaLand.com/join. This episode is brought to you in part by the Douglas Mattress. Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. One of the best, and I mean the best things you can do for yourself is to get a good quality mattress. The time is now, people. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode of Commons is brought to you in part by Canardian. What is Canardian, you ask? Well, it is a podcast that's gossiping about Canadian hometowns. Every episode, podcast producer and writer Katie Lauer is joined by various Canadian podcasting personalities to unravel the juicy stories about their hometowns from trusted sources like eyewitness testimony, community Facebook groups, subreddits, and Wikipedia. Nothing. Nothing I say is fact-checked, but it is pretty dang entertaining. And you know who is a guest on this season of Canardian? Well, none other than yours truly. So if you are interested in the very important distinctions between Surrey and North Delta, if you want to learn whether or not I could outrun the Delta PD, well, this is the podcast for you. Listen and subscribe to Canardian from Pod the North right now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app.